This is week four of a series that I've been calling A Field Guide to the Bodhisattvas. And I see a number of people who haven't been here for the past week, so just a reminder that a bodhisattva means awakening being, and a bodhisattva is a kind of, it's not a deity, not a historical figure, but a kind of archetypal figure who kind of embodies certain qualities of bodhisattvas, who are beings who make a vow to not pursue kind of personal enlightenment, but to stay in the world and help other beings to be free from suffering. So we talked about, we started with Manjushri, the bodhisattva of great wisdom, and then Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva of, he's often called the shining practice bodhisattva, the bodhisattva of activity, and Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of great compassion. And tonight, I'm going to talk about a less well-known bodhisattva called Kshitigarbha, the bodhisattva of great vow. There are many, many more bodhisattvas, countless bodhisattvas, and many stories of their enlightening work in the world. There's, in fact, a bodhisattva story for each one of you. And there are bodhisattva stories of stories of the bodhisattvas that we encounter in our daily lives. Have you been starting to notice them, those of you who have been coming? Yeah? Yeah. See, that's what I'm giving you, the field mark, so you can identify, I know which one that is. Right? So Kshitigarbha, he does not have quite the stature of the previous three that we talked about in terms of doctrine or philosophy or practice, but he is very well known and loved, like Kannon Avalokiteshvara we talked about last week, as a bodhisattva who goes to great lengths to save sentient beings from suffering. He and I'll mostly be calling him Jizo, that's his Japanese name. He and Kannon are both said to travel the six realms of existence. And we'll look at them in a bit, to respond to beings in need. And particularly in Japan, he's very popular and beloved to this day. There's a very rich tradition of folklore and devotional practices that has built up around him, particularly in his role as protector of children. So here's his name. Kshitigarbha is his Sanskrit name. Titsang is in Chinese, and Jizo. That says Jizo Bodhisattva, Bosatsu Bodhisattva. His name means earth storehouse. So that's earth, and that's a kind of storehouse or earth womb. There's not much known about his origin in India, but there's speculation that it could go back very, 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 very ancient pre-Buddhist times to a kind of earth goddess, earth womb goddess. There's in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, when the Buddha is sitting under the Bodhi tree and Mara, the tempter, comes with his armies to tempt Siddhartha and mocks him, saying, "Who do you think you are, that you think you can be a Buddha, think you can awaken? Look at my armies. Who do you have? Who can bear witness to you?" And the Buddha makes the famous gesture of touching the earth. And the earth cracks open, and an earth goddess rises up from the earth and wrings out her hair, and which creates a flood, which floods away Mara's armies. And this is associated with the Hindu earth goddess Prithivi. So the idea of this earth womb is quite beautiful. In the early Indian images, Kshita Garba looks pretty much like the other bodhisattvas. You really couldn't. In fact, although this is Google Images, it said Kshita Garba. I'm a little bit skeptical if it is, because see the lion. That's typically Manjushri.
Yeah.
So, although we don't know, it said Kshita Garba, but the early images look kind of like the other bodhisattvas we've looked at. They're sort of dressed in kind of the clothing of the robes of the nobility in early India. But as he moved into China, he is depicted wearing a monk's robe. See? And a crown. A five-sided crown showing images of the five wisdom Buddhas of esoteric Buddhism. Which this hat like that or crown like that is worn by Tibetan monks, Chinese and Tibetan monks in the esoteric or tantric tradition. There's another one. That's a Tibetan one. Can you see? Maybe I can shove that back just a little bit more so people can see. But in Japan, and that's a little bit small, he starts to look more like a monk with a shaved head. And he typically carries a staff in one hand, and the staff has six rings at the top, symbolizing the six realms of existence, and they jingle as he walks. And the idea being that he's warning little creatures to get out of the way so he won't step on any little creatures. I like the idea that he's also maybe letting the big creatures know that he's coming. You know, like we carry bear bells on the trails. Actually, you know what? All the research says that the sound of bear bells doesn't carry. They're worthless. Yeah, you'd be better off talking loud or singing. So I sing. Rather, bear bells are pretty much useless. But the idea being to let the big creatures that might be dangerous know you're coming so that they don't hurt you and then incur human vengeance, because that's exactly what happens, right? To grizzlies who attack humans, they're toast if they get caught. So this is a way of letting, you know, this is a human being coming, watch out. In his other hand, he carries often a wish-fulfilling jewel. And as we saw, a couple of the other bodhisattvas also, we saw holding this wish-fulfilling jewel, which is the precious jewel of the Dharma. And the wish it fulfills, you know, is not for a BMW. Or even a Prius. But our deepest wish, beneath all our cravings for material things, beneath even our craving for perfect love, but our wish to be free from self-clinging and suffering. So, over the years, centuries, in Japan, he becomes more youthful looking, even childlike, as this association with children became stronger, particularly as a protector of children who have died in infancy or been stillborn, miscarried, or aborted, all those. To see how all this came about, it might help us to see... Yeah, there's a really classic Japanese image of Jizo with his staff and his jewel. It might help us to see how he's portrayed in the one sutra that tells the story of his Kshita Garba's. It's called The Past Vows of Kshita Garba Bodhisattva. And this is how the story goes. At the time of his death, the Buddha said, "I have worked hard for many kalpas to liberate obstinate living beings." Imagine how frustrating. Those who have not yet understood the Dharma will surely fall into states of suffering. So here's the Buddha after his long life. You know, he lived into his early 80s. And there's still a lot of work to be done. So Kashitigarbha Bodhisattva said, even if their good deeds are as little as a hair, a drop of water, a grain of sand, a mote of dust, or a bit of down, I shall gradually help living beings to liberation. World-honored one, do not feel distressed over beings in generations to come. And then he repeated that vow three times, because you always repeat your vows three times. Shakyamuni Buddha was delighted and said, my blessings, I appreciate your strong vows and praise you for your efforts to heal the human world. When you fulfill this great vow, after many kalpas, you will become a Buddha. The sutra then goes on to give quite lurid descriptions of various kinds of hells and Kashitigarbha's role in guiding beings not to fall in, or to move out of the hells or not to fall into them. For us, an awareness of these six realms of existence, the childlike, see how they're very childlike, these images of Jizo, and they wear they wear little bibs often, and these are offerings, immemorial offerings to often children, as I've said, who die young, or there's this little guy with his little panda earphones on. But not only children. Sometimes the Jizos are also memorials to adults who have died. And you see these all over Japan. Okay, there are the six realms. And that's another whole talk to go into these in detail. But just to review, that one, at the bottom of the wheel, these are Tibetan tankas, by the way. Bottom of the wheel is the hell realm. And the hell realm we can think of as a kind of primitive mind. That's our fight, flight, or freeze. You know, our reptile brain. It's the realm of rage and fear. Our kind of most basic fears and angers. And then over to this side is the hungry ghost realm. You've probably heard of that. Hungry ghost realm is the mind of insatiable craving, never enough. It's the mind of addiction. It's the mind of never enough to fill that inside void. And, you know, you could say our culture really kind of reinforces a hungry ghost realm. And over on the other side is the animal realm. We could say that the animal realm is driven by a kind of self-focus for the basic instincts, you know, sex, food. It's not as tormented, I would say, as the hell realm or the hungry ghost realm, but it's not very aware of others' needs. You know, this is what I want, and I'm going to get it. Over on this side is the realm of the asura. We could call them kind of jealous, angry, titans. Sometimes they're called titans. This is the, what's it called, the class A personality?
Type A
personality, thank you. Very competitive, always wants to try and get one up on the next person, full of envy and competition, needs to be the best, the richest, most successful, most spiritual. So this is another kind of torment, being that kind of realm. I'm sure you can think of examples of people who inhabit that realm in our current events. The God realm is up in the top. The God realm is the realm of ease and complacency. And people can stay in that God realm for quite a while, but it's also easily destabilized, so that someone in the God realm can kind of plummet down into one of those other realms pretty easily. And we see examples of that in our in our world as well, when things fall apart. And over, of course, here is the human realm. The human realm is the mind of self-improvement, right? That's what we're really, we want to be better humans. It's not as tormented as the Asura realm. But it's the mind of, the human realm is the mind of dissatisfaction, always needing things to be better than they are, but also with enough self-awareness to be aware of our own suffering and to pay attention. So the human realm is considered to be the realm where it's most possible to awaken, right? Best situated for practice. So because of his travels through these six realms, Jizo Bodhisattva became known in Japan as the protector of travelers. And so you see groups of... Oops, oh, sorry, I'm going to go ahead for a minute. Six Jizos all over, and often at crossroads. And that's six for the six realms. So, just backing up. This is a shrine, a Jizo shrine, on a busy in a very busy shopping arcade in the middle of Kyoto. And it's just tucked in between, in a row of stores. And, These are called Ema. They're about this big. They're wooden little plaques, and you can get them in different temples and shrines all over Japan. And they have kind of folk art pictures on them. And on the back, people write their prayers and wishes. These are ones that I've never seen anywhere else. They're quite lurid. There's Jizo rescuing beings, you know, in this, from the flames of hell, and they're demons. So that's pretty gruesome looking, Ema. But if you can read the wishes on the back, they're quite moving oftentimes. And there's the six Jizos. This one is called the makeup Jizo. He always has rosy cheeks. Can you see? And often they have little knitted or crocheted hats to keep their shaved heads warm. This close, you know, close relationship with women and women's health, and there are a lot of legends around Jizo, but there's and stories about people who are kind of transformation bodies of Jizo, who were. I'll tell you one in particular of two young women, and this would have been in China, who were said to be very distressed about their mother's fate. The mothers had died, and the young women were afraid that their mothers were suffering in hell. You don't think of Buddhism as emphasizing hell so much, but these are images of a kind of internal restlessness and suffering. One of the mothers, apparently, had slandered Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and the other was gluttonous and particularly indulged in eating turtles and their eggs. So even back then, being greedy about eating turtles and their eggs was not good. Now it's even worse. She also often spoke ill of others. Now that's one of the precepts, is not to speak ill of others, not to slander. So these two daughters devoted themselves to deep meditation and prayed for their mother's release from suffering. They saw visions of torment in the hell realms. But by their steady efforts, their mothers were released, and the young women, moved by the suffering of the many beings still left behind, vowed to continue their practice until all beings were liberated, and then were seen as manifestations of Kshitigarbha. But when you think about it, don't we resonate strongly, even well into adulthood, with our own parents' suffering? Right? We wish them to be relieved of their suffering. It's a very deep thing in us. Because, well, ultimately, if our parents are relieved from their suffering, then they can love us the way we wish to be loved. Right? So there's something quite, I think, primal about this wish for the healing of our parents that these stories express. And there is some mysterious way that when we develop compassion in our own hearts, that we unravel the karmic knots that go back through the generations. And in some sense, we do heal our parents. And we free them and ourselves. So as I said, this role of protector of children and women goes back to this early sutra, and this association with the earth womb going all the way back to India. In Japan, there are examples of what were called naked jizos, which were carved as women and then dressed as jizo in his monk's robe. And they've been found in temples. The jizo image on the altar, you might want to look when you go out, the one on the left, is a female jizo, commissioned by a Zen teacher in Oregon, Jan Chosen Bays, from a master carver in Bali. And she's quite lovely. So once again, the sort of gender shifting, we've seen this before, gender shifting androgynous quality of bodhisattva images lets us know that we all have these capacities, bodhisattva capacities within us. In medieval Japan, there were women's associations devoted to Jizo, which sponsored yearly children's festivals celebrating Jizo, while at the same time memorializing the spirits of children who had died, or pregnancies lost to stillbirth, miscarriage, or abortion, or even infanticide. I mean, this goes back to the years of the shogunate, when there were times when peasants were extremely poor, there was starvation, pestilence. Young children were really not considered fully born until they made it through their first year of life, right? Because there were so many hazards. Amongst the very poor, infanticide was practiced. You know, if another baby comes and there's still a baby nursing, sometimes the midwife would if there was a weak infant, the midwife would quietly be asked to take care of them. Take care of them usually would mean drowning. It sounds brutal, but this is the reality in Europe as well, and such times. The folkloric image is of these babies, images of these little toddlers on the shore of the River Sai. Sort of like Styx, the River Styx, but it's called the River Sai, stacking stones into little towers, little stupas. And demons come along and kick over the stupas over and over again. The children have to stack them up again. And then Jizo, you see these, I don't think I have good ones of this, of Jizo coming along and helping the children to move on from this kind of limbo. It's kind of a grim story, but it also kind of reflects, I think, the anxiety parents feel who have lost a child, about the fate of that child. When I used to work for hospice, I used to counsel parents, women who had lost a child. And they would say, I heard them say any number of times, I just wish I could know for sure she's okay. I just wish I could know for sure she's okay, that she's not suffering, that she's happy. Right? And so this image of Jizo offering that is very powerful, I think. So to this day, you will find temples. These are probably little grave markers that are disturbed, where there's no one tending the grave anymore, where there's redevelopment. The grave markers will be gathered and clustered together and honored as Jizos. That's probably what this, I'm pretty sure that's what this one is. But this is a Jizo shrine. There he is in the middle with those, again, those little emma, these would be offerings from parents who have lost children in some way or another, and they'll write little messages like, please forgive us. And sometimes they'll say, your parents and children are in your debt, or I'm so sorry, please rest in peace. Most are signed by the mother, it'll just say mother, or father, more recent years. In Japan, which is a country with a high standard of living and a very low birth rate, and until recently a very limited repertoire of contraceptive methods, abortion is both legal and rates are fairly high. So there's been some criticism of this practice. These are called Mizuko Jizos. This practice of Mizuko rituals. Mizuko means water baby. And so that might refer to the womb, the amniotic fluid, or also maybe indirectly to that practice of sending these unborn or born infants into the next world. That was the sense of what was happening, sending them flowing on into the next world. But there's been some criticism of this as a kind of profiting, temples profiting from women's sense of guilt at ending a pregnancy. So that's all these are Mizuko Jizos with their little hats. That one has a little moss shawl. But at best, I think these practices give a way of recognizing and expressing a loss, whether through death or miscarriage or personal choice. It's a way of honoring and remembering. Perhaps there is something we can learn from this compassionate response of Jizo Bodhisattva to the circumstances of women's lives, of families' lives. There are some Western Zen centers that have begun to offer Jizo ceremonies that are very inclusive for anyone who's experienced any loss of a child or of a pregnancy, or also parents who've lost an adult child. So very, you know, widely interpreted. This is Jan Cho Zenbeis, who I mentioned, who commissioned the Jizo. Sorry, it's a blurry picture. She practices at Great Vow Monastery in Oregon as the abbot there, and for many years she worked as a pediatrician in a clinic for children who had been physically or sexually abused, and often she'd be called upon to testify in court. She saw some of the most painful results of human greed, hatred, and ignorance, the consequences for children. And she had to look with a calm body, unflinching eyes, and a compassionate heart at some of the worst things we can do as human beings. And she had to use the best tools of her profession and of her Dharma practice. And when she discovered Jizo Bodhisattva, he became kind of her patron Bodhisattva. Right? and the source of the name of the monastery, Great Vow Monastery, that she founded. And the inspiration for a pilgrimage, a peace pilgrimage to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2005. Michael and I went on that pilgrimage. It was an amazing experience. It was the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombing of those cities. The group took the intention, and this was over 2 years in preparation, was to take an image of Jizo Bodhisattva for each of the 270,000 people who died within the first year of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mostly were in the form of prayer flags, but also clay and fabric, all kinds of Jizos. And we took all these and did two exhibitions in Hiroshima, one in Nagasaki, in a temple and a peace museum. And this caught on. People from all over, you know, every state and quite a few different countries were sending in Jizos, and there were over 500,000 that we took. And I could tell you much more about that experience, but this is, for those of you who were here last week, remember I showed an image of Kannon Bodhisattva with two little, an old man and an old woman. This is a new kind, and this is of dementia preventing Bodhisattva. So this is a dementia preventing Jizo. That's an old man and an old woman at his feet. And this is outside the cemetery of Rinzoin, which is Suzuki Roshi's temple, where we go and visit when we go to Japan. I'm just going to show you a couple more pictures. This guy's got a tie. And a big hat. This is a little shrine that Michael and I just stumbled upon in Kanazawa, which is a beautiful old regional city in Japan. And inside, it's very, very old. There are all these old, old, old Jizos. And there was, we met the priest who lived in the temple next door, and there was an amazing amount of lore. But the interesting, just the one I'll show you, is see this one who's turning, looking backwards? His name was the Turning Backwards Jizo. There are all kinds of different specific Jizos. But this was a route where prisoners were taken to be executed back in the days of the shogunate. And I'm not going to tell this exactly right, but there was something about this Jizo was looking back, with this feeling of compassion for the prisoners who are leaving their lives behind and going towards death. So, is that the last? Yeah, I'll leave it back. So, I'd just like to invite you all to reflect on, as we've done with each of these bodhisattvas, reflect on your own lives and those you've met or heard about who are doing the work of Jizo Bodhisattva in the world. There are many ways in this world to travel the six realms as transformation bodies of Jizo Bodhisattva, not turning away from all of the different kinds of suffering that we encounter. Sometimes that might mean taking care of basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, water, health care. Sometimes it means just sitting still, calmly, being a still, calm presence, able to listen. Don't think that bodhisattva work means preaching, even though, some of us get up and do these Dharma talks. They're just one more practice, like ringing bells, like doing like cooking a meal. In Zen practice, we make everything that we do a bodhisattva practice and a bodhisattva offering. Sometimes, mostly, in fact, our bodhisattva work is simply manifesting who we are as fully as we can in the world, in each moment. And of course, we always fall short of our ideals, of how we should be. And that's when we learn what great vows really are. They're not bludgeons to make us behave, but they're vast safety nets of connection that hold us always. Great vows are good for the long haul. That's what we can learn from Jizo Bodhisattva. So I'm going to close and thank you for listening.